This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
Point number 8, naturalism's inconsistencies. Naturalism witnesses to its irrationalism, its non-rationality, by several inconsistencies. First, with respect to God. If naturalism is true, there is no transcendent God. But here is Lewis's repeated question. Why is it then that human beings imagining that there's a transcendent being beyond the natural world? Isn't that fascinating? Really, at the heart of Lewis's apologetics is the insatiable longing for heaven. Isn't it interesting how many of the naturalists, when somebody dies, will talk about his going to a place of glory? Heaven is affirmed, hell is denied, but that nonetheless reflects a deep, inconsolable longing in the heart of even many an atheist. The moment someone suggests that there is in fact such a being beyond nature and beyond nature's control, he or she has ceased to be a thoroughgoing naturalist. Many contemporary advocates of the New Age movement themselves are apologists for the inadequacy of naturalism. Many New Agers are reacting against pure materialism. There's a spiritual being beyond the material, but we will emphatically not affirm a transcendent sovereign God. Point B, with respect to reason. Naturalists offer rational arguments to support a position which provides no basis for using reason. If reason is in fact to be used, to be effective and trustworthy, it must stand outside the system that is being defended. Naturalists offer rational arguments to support a position which itself provides no basis for the use of reason. If reason is in fact to be used, it must stand outside that which it articulates and defends. In the New Age movement, as some of you know, cosmic consciousness transcends reason. And you can point out the logical fallacies of New Age argumentation, and they say that just shows you that reason is not to be trusted. Let me give you another quote from the Screwtape Letters. Number 7. And this goes back to what I was saying about the interlacing of naturalism and New Age spirituality. Screwtape observes that when people believe in the demon's existence, they're not subject to become magicians. And that when people do believe in demons' existence, they cannot be made into pure materialists. Do you understand what he's saying there? If you believe in the demons, then it's hard to make the person a pure naturalist. If they disbelieve in the demons, then it's hard to make them a magician. What we want, says Screwtape, is the materialist magician. Many of our contemporaries are materialist magicians. They would say, we're naturalists. There's no transcendent God, and yet we affirm the reality of a spiritual world beyond the naturalistic. That's an inner contradiction. The materialist magician. Let's pray. Dear Father, refresh us with your holy and mighty and gracious presence. Give us eyes to see Christ. Give us hearts to love Him. Give us lives to honor Him. And as the outer man perishes, let the inner man be renewed. In this very hour we pray for Jesus' sake. Amen. Just a few illustrations of how naturalists appeal to moral standards all the time. Xdor says that naturalism is a parasite on Christian theism. Indeed, all worldviews, insofar as they reflect the truth at all, are parasites on Christian theism. A naturalist may say that morality is relative and then betray it a moment later. Just reflect on your own experience. A naturalist may break his promise to you, but he will become enraged if you break your promise to him. See further the law of human nature, which is chapter 1 of Mere Christianity. Just to elaborate, we ourselves may fail to adhere to this standard of right and wrong, what Lewis calls the law of human nature, but we betray our acknowledgement of it in the demands we place upon others. Some of you are old enough to remember the celebrated blackout of New York City some years ago. And as reported in the news magazines, there was naturally wholesale looting during the time of the blackout. Nothing surprising about that. What was intriguing was the outrage that some of the looters felt when other looters stole their property that they had just looted. Cornelius Plantinga, who's just written a very fine book entitled Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, A Breviary of Sin, about the best on the subject since the Screwtape Letters, in my judgment. He says this: we address people who have been trained to believe that whatever goes wrong in the world is someone else's fault. The capitalists, the government, the Nazis, the parents, etc. Compare today's obsession with the victim mentality. The very fact that you consider yourself a victim implies that someone has done wrong. But if morality is relative, what right do you have to call yourself a victim or someone else a wrongdoer? In Miracles, page 45, I don't know the chapter, Lewis makes this point. A Marxist may passionately advocate that the wealthy and ruling classes ought to be overthrown. But what's an atheist's right to use the word ought? Lewis says, if naturalism is true, I ought is the same sort of statement as I itch. He goes on in that same chapter of Miracles to say this: a consistent Freudian would explain a child's murder of his father by appealing to childhood trauma. If the analyst went on to recommend punishment of the child, on what basis would that punishment be prescribed? It's one thing to explain by reference to childhood trauma why a child would murder his father, but why ought the child therefore to be punished? We'll come back to this when we consider social and ethical issues. In the humanitarian theory of punishment, the wrongdoer becomes a what? A patient. Not accidental that in the Screwtape Letters, the new Christian is called a patient. He needs to be rehabilitated. C.S. Lewis's own thinking provides a case in point. when he was inundating Arthur Greaves with all of these naturalistic arguments against Christian theism, Arthur Greaves very perceptively responded, "Why don't you commit suicide?" You know, that's logically the end to which some existentialists came. Lewis responds that his being an atheist did not relieve him of all moral responsibility to himself and his community. That's a parasite on Christian theism. These are things we owe to our manhood and dignity, quite apart from belief in gods. I'm reminded of the existentialist Woody Allen. If you've ever seen a Woody Allen movie, you've seen existentialism placard all over the place. You know, Woody Allen says, "I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Here's an existentialist statement from his film, Hannah and Her Sisters. "Life is meaningless, but let's laugh anyway." That's what you call whistling in the dark. Life is meaningless, but let's laugh anyway. Here is the center of the tragedy. In naturalism, man is both enthroned and subjugated. He's the measure of all things. But within a system of naturalism, he has no adequate basis for governing himself. Is not man subject to the same random progress of events as are the animals and the trees? You know, I wrote a book on Pauline theology, and one thing that gripped me was that, according to Paul, a human being is at no time more enslaved than when he considers himself to be master of his own destiny. The autonomous self is both king and slave simultaneously. So C.S. Lewis rightly argues that attempts to subdue nature to man inevitably lead to the abolition of man. Because man trying to subdue nature without moral constraints and directives is doomed to destruction by the very powers he seeks to subjugate. Now, if that went over your head, don't worry. We're going to come back to that when we consider issues in education. But just consider, what's the best example from our own generation? The nuclear arsenal. A marvel of technology, but how do we handle that? Now, you have to take on what Tom Howard calls the burden of the God without God. How do you fulfill the cultural mandate of Genesis 1:28 if you're no longer under the sovereignty of the God who issued the command? Let's look at naturalism's counterfeits. Peter Kraft is right in his book, C.S. Lewis in the Third Millennium. Man cannot live without gods. Cases in point all around us. If we deny the true God, we are so constituted that we have to have objects of worship, which is a marvelous argument in favor of Christian theism. Peter Kraft says that there are three false gods dominating contemporary American culture. The first god is Molech, M-O-L-E-C-H, god of the ancient Ammonites. Worship of Molech involved sacrificing children in the fire. The temples of Molech in our culture are the abortion clinics, and many a private home where children are sacrificed or very close to it. The second god is the goddess Ashtoreth, Asthoreth, the Canaanite goddess of fertility and love. Our whole culture idolizes sexuality. It's got to be brought in at every point. You can hardly see a film today where there's not at least the innuendo. There's a marvelous passage in Mere Christianity where this is exhibited. If people gather in a theater and bow droolingly before a pork chop, when pork chops are available in every food store and in every restaurant, you would have to think that something has gone awry in that culture. Our culture offers sex at every point, at every juncture, at every turn, and yet there's the insatiable craving for more. An outsider would have to say our society is sick in its devotion to Ashtoreth. What do you think the third god is in Christ's unholy trinity? Mammon. Molech, Ashtoreth, and Mammon. Isn't it interesting how we're slaves to Mammon, and Jesus says you cannot be a slave to God and money. He doesn't say you should not. You cannot simultaneously be slaves to two masters. And yet, we're on the verge of economic chaos, which just shows that devotion to a false god always proves to be destructive for its devotees. Secondly, false dominion. The true God gave his creatures dominion nature under his sovereignty. Brothers and sisters, deprived of God's sovereignty over us, we cannot be trusted to exercise responsible sovereignty over nature. Again, Tom Howard says in an article published years ago in Christianity Today, the burden of the God. We don't have the wisdom or the power to take up that burden. I don't. It must have been 25 years ago. As fallen creatures, how do we exercise our dominion? By dominating other people. Chiefly by two means, violence and sex, and often together. Someone who came from the Middle Ages and went into a movie theater in our culture would be shocked to the point of cardiac arrest, just as you would be if you've never been on drugs and suddenly took a dosage of cocaine that a junkie was accustomed to. Just reflect for a moment how violence together with sexuality dominate contemporary film. Thirdly, false joy. If the true joy found only in God is denied or repudiated, then phony counterfeit joys will inevitably be sought to fill the void. St. Thomas Aquinas, the Catholic theologian, says that those who lose spiritual joy will replace it with carnal joy. So the worship of sexuality in our culture is both tragic and hopeful, is it not? Because many people are seeking in sexuality a joy and an intimacy that is to be found only in God. And the tragedy is that, again, if you seek second things as first things, you lose second things. Let's turn now to the historical perspective. The more I study Lewis, the more I realize that he was truly prophetic. The writings of the 40s and the 50s are coming to pass in our own day. In 1954, Lewis became professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. A post was created for him. His inaugural lecture was called, in Latin, De Descriptione Temporum, describing the times. It's reprinted in the collection, They Asked for a Paper. I'm not sure where else it's reprinted. Some of you may know. His inaugural lecture at Cambridge, 1954, describing the times. I find this very illuminating. Number one, he distinguishes three historical epochs. Number one, the pre-Christian epoch. Number two, the Christian epoch. And number three, the post-Christian. The shift from the pre-Christian epoch to the Christian occurs with the incarnation of the Son of God. Anno Domini, A.D. And reaches its zenith or its apex in the Middle Ages. The shift, according to Lewis, from the Christian epoch to the post-Christian began between the time of Jane Austen and Sir Walter Scott and today. If somebody knows the dates for Jane Austen, I'll give you an A for the course. Time's up. Jane Austen was a Christian. If you read Pride and Prejudice, you will be delighted to find a romance without any sexuality overtly displayed. Marvelous book. I watched it on television, went back and reread it. The television is very close to the book. Jane Austen, 1775 to 1817. That's the year Mississippi became a state. Sir Walter Scott, 1771 to 1832. So they were contemporaries. The shift, says Lewis, from the Christian epoch to the post-Christian took place sometime between the dates of Jane Austen and Sir Walter Scott in the late 18th and early 19th centuries and our own day. Now, point number two. Two versus one. Lewis contends that of these three epochs, the first two have more in common with each other than either does with the third. I find this fascinating. The first two epochs, the pre-Christian and the Christian, have more in common with each other than either does with the third. And here's a quotation that's really the inspiration for Peter Kreif's latest book, Ecumenical Jihad. More on that in a moment. This quotation is taken from page 14 of that collection They Asked for a Paper. But this is not a long lecture. You can track it down. The gap between those who worship different gods is not so wide as that between those who worship and those who do not. Think about that. The gap between those who worship different gods is not so wide as that between those who worship and those who do not. The pagans, the ancient pagans, had a metaphysics. I remember being struck by that as I was teaching on Matthew chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. When you pray, do not be like the pagans who heap up words in order to manipulate the God, to wear him down. Batalogeo, heaping up words, but at least in the minds of those pagans, there was a God or an assembly of gods, a pantheon out there. Even the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel had a metaphysics. Both ancient pagans and medieval Christians thought of themselves this way. This is an image from G.K. Chesterton. a great influence on Lewis. Ancient pagans and medieval Christians thought of themselves neither as a balloon flying loose in the sky, like our spiritualizing New Agers, neither as a balloon flying in the sky, nor as a mole burrowing in the earth, like our modern materialists, but as a tree with roots firmly planted in the earth and branches reaching up to the heavens. The book by Peter Crape, Ecumenical Jihad, is an appeal for theists to become co-belligerents against atheists. He calls upon Christians, Jews, and Muslims to become co-belligerents. He's not advocating a watered-down kind of ecumenical theology. He's a champion of orthodox theism. But he is saying, in a war on atheism and secularism, there are areas in which we might effectively be co-belligerents. That's Francis Schaeffer's term. Well, I'm not trying to underscore or dismiss Crape's contention in that book, but just to illustrate Lewis's point about those with metaphysics having more in common than those with metaphysics over against those who are pure naturalists. Number three, marks of the post-Christian epoch. See if this doesn't sound prophetic. Still from that same inaugural lecture, he gives four changes that mark the shift from the Christian to the post-Christian epoch. Changes in politics from ruler to leader. Lewis subscribes to the hierarchy of being, and the ideal ruler is a monarch, a king, who recognizes himself to be under law given by the King of Kings. In all previous ages, the principal aim of rulers is to keep their subjects quiet, to forestall widespread turbulence and persuade people to attend quietly to their several occupations. The task of government is not to initiate, but to preserve the domestic tranquility. Listen to 1 Timothy 2, verse 2. Pray for kings and all those in authority that we may live peaceful and quiet lives. If you don't believe the government's interfering in your life, read George Will's columns. Government by interference. Now we have not rulers, but leaders. Our demand upon them has changed no less than theirs on us. What do you ask of a ruler? That he seek justice, incorruption, diligence, clemency. What do you ask of a leader? Magnetism, personality. Compare attitudes to George Washington to attitudes toward John Kennedy. Interesting to me that the whole Kennedy White House was called Camelot, but King Arthur was a king. We don't want a king who will rule us according to a law beyond himself. Remember Schaeffer's book, However, How Should We Then Live? When you go from lex rex to rex lex, you've crossed a great divide. Law is king as opposed to king. In the Middle Ages, the king was under the law. Lex was rex. Law was king. In our day, the king is often thought to be the source or origin of law. Pay close attention to how a nominee's handlers will help him get votes this year by projecting an image of personal magnetism. Just reflect on that for a moment, even at this hour of the day. In supernaturalism, Your view of reality is monarchical. Monarchy means one ruler only. And the king is the triune God. In naturalism, what other political system could you possibly advocate than democracy if all views are equally valid, when you have no basis for distinguishing one from the other? What's going to happen, though, when you become a pure democracy? What are you preparing for? You're preparing... Here's the irony. You're preparing for a despot. You're preparing for a tyrant, because a pure democracy is going to assure anarchy, chaos. Yes. One would have to read his little essay in the collection, Present Concerns. And there he does argue for representative democracy, like a parliament, because given the fallenness of humanity, there must be a kind of checks and balances. It's only when God is king that monarchy can be trusted. Otherwise, it degenerates into tyranny. Read the first sentence of Democratic Education. I think that's it.
Democratic Education, says Aristotle, ought to mean not the education that Democrats like, but the education which will preserve democracy.
Go on, read a little bit more.
Until we have realized that the two things do not necessarily go together, we cannot think fairly about education.
It must be another one, but I can't come up with the title of it.
Equality?
Yeah, read the first sentence of that.
I'm a Democrat because I believe in the fall of man.
Yeah.
I think most people are Democrats for the opposite reason. A great deal of Democratic enthusiasm descends from the ideas of people like Rousseau, who believed in democracy because they thought mankind so wise and good that everyone deserved a share in the government.
Yeah, and that's the essay Equality from the collection Present Concerns. That would be an excellent one to read in this regard. James Madison devised the Constitution as he did because he believed in the fallenness of man. So the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government had to exercise checks and balances on one another. Let's look, secondly, at changes in the arts, comprehension to bewilderment. Here, one of Lewis's ideas later to be considered is shining through. He says this, again in that same inaugural lecture, no previous age produced work which was in its own time so shatteringly and bewilderingly new as that of the Cubists, the Dadaists, the Surrealists, for example, Salvador Dali, and Picasso has been in ours. In Screwtape Proposes a Toast, Lewis speaks of much contemporary art as nothing but spilled sensibilities. And if we fail to appreciate them, that says more about us than about the artist. What's shining through here, something we'll come to later, is what Lewis calls the personal heresy in literary criticism. What's the task of a poet or a playwright or a novelist? To reveal something from the depths of his own being, or to point outward and upward to something that far transcends himself? We'll come back to that. The saint... spilled sensibilities. My guess is no. I haven't read that book, so I couldn't say for sure. I think it simply means whatever is going on inside the artist is projected into the art, and the very fact that he or she does that puts us in his or her debt. And if we fail to appreciate it, it's not the artist's fault. He's been genuine and sincere. It's our fault for failing to appreciate it. But as I say, we'll come back to that. The same is true in poetry. And this is a rather striking statement, again from the inaugural lecture. In the past, so long as one could read the language in which the poem was written, unanimity of interpretation could be expected. Most importantly, the poem could be expected to direct the reader's attention beyond itself to some objective reality. What is the task of deconstructionism? I'm not sure to what extent you're familiar with that term. A deconstructionist says that a poem is not supposed to mean anything beyond itself, which is consistent with pure naturalism. Compare what Jim Sire calls the conceptual relativist version of New Age thought, where the self's aroused consciousness creates and controls its own version of reality, no one of which is any more real than another. You may have heard of the psychologist Carl Rogers, who has said, there are as many real worlds as there are people. So, if cosmic consciousness consists merely in getting in touch with your own deepest level of being, and you project that into a poem, it's not supposed to mean anything beyond itself, except as a reflection of the poet's own inner being.
Are you saying that only the poor can understand it?
I think a consistent relativist would say it doesn't matter what understanding is attached to it. If you as a reader interpret it one way, that's just as true as is the poet's own original intention, which becomes chaotic when it comes, let us say, to biblical interpretation. It's mirrored in a Bible study where we just go around and say, what does this text mean to you? It's not that there's no personal application to the objective reality of the text, but if the meaning of the text is exhausted in what the readers think it means, then we have taken a perilous course.
I'm a little unclear. Was Lewis in this particular lecture, was he just analyzing the current conditions of things, or was he making a judgment?
He was sounding a warning. Definitely. He's really calling for us to go back to a medieval view of reality.
So his idea then would be that classical art would be much better for humanity than the...
Definitely. Definitely. Francis Schaeffer, though not nearly so eloquent a writer as Lewis, is really getting at the same thing when he writes about the chaos of modern culture.
See, that's kind of hard. I mean, 100 years from now, people might be looking back and saying, well, this was the greatest period of art, someone like Lewis, in 2050, going back and saying, well, the greatest blooming of art and humanity took place during the time of Picasso and Salvador Dali.
I think if that were to happen, Lewis would say that generation's view is even more distorted than ours. Okay, thirdly, changes in religion, Christian to post-Christian. There were many pagans in Jane Austen's day, of course, as there are many Christians in our day. But the presumption has changed. The presumption has changed. In Jane Austen's day, some kind and degree of religious conviction were the norm. Now they are the exception. Let me give you an image from Lewis's book on medieval culture called The Discarded Image. In our day, in modernism, as the effect of evolutionary thought, a human being stands at the top of a stair whose foot is lost in obscurity. Now just image that. In modernism, in evolutionary thought, is the effect of evolutionary thought. Modern man stands at the top of a stair, the bottom of which is shrouded in obscurity. Yeah, you could say that, yeah. He doesn't develop it to that point, but yeah. Yeah, the elan vital has carried humanity to the apex of the whole natural order. Now, in medieval thought, the human being stands at the bottom of a stair whose top is invisible with light. There's a complete inversion. In medieval thought, God is the center of reality. Listen, we've all been infected to some degree by this. Don't we think of the real world as the world we occupy and God sort of peering in from the outside? Whereas the medieval view, and it's all there in Dante's Divine Comedy, that ought to be required reading for every Christian. In Dante, we are on the outside looking into the heart of reality. That's why Lewis is so passionately concerned about taking us to a window and having us look out onto the vistas of those great transcendent and invisible realities. And then fourthly, changes in technology, the birth of machines. According to Lewis, the birth of machines, the Industrial Revolution and all of its sequel, places us at a greater distance from Jane Austen and Sir Walter Scott than they were from Virgil and Homer. I haven't gotten to the bottom of this, but I think there's something really important going on here. What has contributed to our chronological snobbery so much as the advances of technology? Do we not, if only subconsciously, consider progress to be electronic and mechanical? I bought a computer 6 years ago. It's already ancient. It's already obsolete. Compare the way Jane Austen and William Shakespeare, like Virgil and Homer, wrote out what they had to say. We have advanced from the manual typewriter to the electronic typewriter to the personal computer. George Will, my favorite political columnist, says this: "We live in an age of journalism, an age of skimmed surfaces, a facile confidence that reality is whatever can be seen and taped and recorded." Have any of you seen Peter Kreis' book, The Snakebite Letters? Have you seen that? Well, he acknowledges, of course, his indebtedness to the Screwtape Letters. But in this up-to-date counterpart to the Screwtape Letters, Snakebite, a senior demon, is writing to his nephew, Brain Twister. Listen to this. "The human's world is getting more like hell every year. The three S words, silence, solitude, and simplicity, are nearly extinct. They need leisure as much as they need work. So we've been at work abolishing leisure from their land through all the same time-saving devices of modern technology." Just think about that. They need leisure as much as they need work. So we've been at work abolishing leisure from their land through all the time-saving devices of modern technology. Isn't that true? How many of us, when once we get a computer, we become more frantic than before? I've got to get on the internet. I've got to get on email. I've got to answer that letter before he returns. The three S words are becoming extinct: solitude, silence, and simplicity.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.